Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, I'll be playing more of the music of a genius jazz artist who finally found fame in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and who would end his career in the 1970s with a long retreat into silence. And I'll also be talking with his biographer, Robin D.G. Kelly. It's Thelonious Monk, From Myth to Man, coming up next on Nightlights. Thelonious Monk performing his composition Bemshaw Swing with Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, Butch Warren on bass, and Frankie Dunlop on drums, recorded in Tokyo, Japan in May of 1963, when Butch Warren was still pretty new to Monk's working quartet, and that concert from Monk's first tour of Japan, a country in which Monk had a long-standing interest, and a country where the jazz press had been championing Monk since the late 1950s. Biographer Robin D.G. Kelly says that Japanese audiences loved Monk and often applauded as they recognized the opening bars of various Monk tunes, another sign of how far the pianist star had risen in just a few years. In 1955, Thelonious Monk, still without a New York City cabaret card that would allow him to legally perform in nightclubs, was nevertheless on the move, signing with Riverside Records, a label where he'd make albums like Brilliant Corners that would establish him as a widely respected jazz artist. Riverside wanted to reintroduce Monk to the record-buying public, so they first had him record an album of standards and an album of Duke Ellington songs. Here's Caravan from Thelonious Monk Plays Duke Ellington. Doing Duke Ellington's Caravan from one of his first records for the Riverside label. Robin D.G. Kelly, author of Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, talks about Monk's producer at Riverside, Orrin Keepnews.
He had known Monk for quite some time. He had interviewed him for an article he published in the Record Changer. You know, he actually met in 1948. And that interview was probably one of the best profiles written about Monk at that time in the late 40s. And so Keepnews took Monk's music very seriously. He understood it. He, you know, cared about it and felt like Monk would be Riverside's most important artist. After they put out those two albums, both Ellington and Standards, Unique Thelonious Monk, that's when they were ready to put out Monk's own compositions. And the result was Brilliant Corners, which won international prizes. It was really Monk's breakout record, more than anything else up to that point. And an amazing recording with new compositions, Brilliant Corners being the title track, perhaps most important of the compositions recorded on that LP.
Brilliant Corners was so hard for the musicians to play that they nearly rebelled against Monk in the studio, and Keepnews had to piece the final recording together from 25 different takes, Robin D.G. Kelly.
It's a difficult song because, first of all, the kind of harmonic architecture is unlike anything else. It's sort of written in a circle, you know, with descending chord changes in the bridge. The other thing is it's a 36-bar song with a 7-bar bridge, and the musicians were like, we don't understand this. It makes no sense because, you know, most music, the Tin Pan Alley song form is like 32 bars. It was 8-bar bridge, 16 bars. I mean, everything's divided up evenly. But you got a 7-bar bridge and you have to really think through, you know, what's happening here. And so Oscar Pettiford was complaining about it. What is wonderful about the song, though, is that once they get past the melody, which is a melody that with a tempo, double time, written into the melody itself. The tempo sort of begins slow, like a slow dirge, and then double time, and goes back again. Each soloist is outstanding. I mean, Sonny Rollins' solo is just mind-blowing, and Ernie Henry, one of the unsung heroes of the alto saxophone, just plays brilliantly. Max Roach is brilliant. I mean, they all sound fantastic. Monk's compact solo is one of those things for the museums, you know? And yet, you know, they really labored over that song.
Thelonious Monk performing the title tune from his Riverside album Brilliant Corners, with saxophonists Sonny Rollins and Ernie Henry, Oscar Pettiford on bass, and Max Roach on drums. Sonny Rollins was one of Monk's most compatible saxophonists, but in 1957 Monk teamed up with another tenor player who was launching his own great jazz journey, John Coltrane.
I think Monk's relationship to Coltrane is, that alone could be a great book, great movie. Coltrane, when he first met Monk, it was about 1955. Train had been playing with Miles Davis, with the quintet. He actually had a heroin issue then. Monk seemed to be surrounded by people, even though he himself wasn't using, who had this issue. And so Monk took on almost like a fatherly role when it came to Coltrane. He invited him over to the house. He'd sit. They'd talk about music. When Monk was in Philadelphia on a gig, I think in 1956, and he was using Paul Chambers in his band, the bass player, he visited Coltrane as Coltrane was trying to go cold turkey, and they developed a really close friendship. When Miles eventually fired Coltrane, it was temporarily, Monk offered Coltrane a job, and eventually he became part of his very famous quartet that opened at the Five Spot in July of 1957. And Coltrane talks lovingly about how much he learned from Monk, and he tells stories about how he'd arrive in the morning at Monk's house, and Nellie would make him breakfast, and Monk would still be asleep, and then he'd wake up and he'd say, okay, play this, and then he'd go back to sleep. And then Coltrane would be practicing, whether it's Monk's Mood or Ruby My Dear, and he'd practicing, and then, you know, Monk would listen to him until he's ready, and he'd come out and they'd play together. And this is almost a ritual. I wouldn't say it was daily, but it was very frequent.
Thank you.
Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane at Carnegie Hall in 1957 performing Monk's Epistrophe with Ahmad Abdul-Malik on bass and Shadow Wilson on drums. That same year, finally armed with a cabaret card again, Monk was leading a group with Coltrane and holding down a gig at a hip underground New York City club, the Five Spot, that drew painters, poets, musicians, and other downtown hipsters. It was there, Robin Kelly says, that Monk found a devoted following that would, along with the success of Brilliant Corners, begin lifting his name to national and even global recognition.
Monk needed his own unique audience. And who was that audience? It was an audience that could appreciate abstract expressionism as expressed in music. People who saw the new modern era as one of free expression, bodily expression, performance art, conceptual art. Monk embodied all these things, you know, from his dance on stage to when you went to see Monk at the Five Spot, it wasn't just the music. It was a whole performance. It was an avant-garde performance. I mean, he'd get up, he'd dance. He'd shuffle to the bar and get his drink. He'd shuffle back. He'd be sweating. He'd pull out these huge handkerchiefs that Nellie would make for him out of sheep. And he'd wipe his brow. And then he would flip it, like out. So sweat's going all over the place. And it became part of the whole sort of performance of Monk. And he understood that. He was a showman. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Saxophonist Johnny Griffin performing Blues Five Spot at the Five Spot nightclub in New York City in 1958 with Ahmad Abdul-Malik on bass and Roy Haynes on drums. As Monk's career started to take off, he remained deeply rooted in his family life at home with his two children and his wife Nellie. Nellie Monk has often been characterized simply as Monk's all-important helpmate, and while Robin Kelly acknowledges that role as part of her life, he says he tried to present her in a much fuller way.
What I try to do is tell her story. I go back and tell the story of her family, the Smiths. I basically locate Nellie in Monk's childhood, along with Nellie's brother, Sonny, and show that they have a long relationship going way, way back. Monk, when he fell in love with her, was so committed to her. There's no evidence of infidelity or even consideration of it. Nellie certainly paid her dues, but at the same time, she was very knowledgeable about the music. I have homemade recordings of her singing Introspection and teaching some piano player how to play it. She didn't play piano herself, but she knew the music. She could hum any Monk song, and certainly most of his solos. Later in his life, you know, when she was traveling with him constantly, she was the one who was making choices about who to hire and fire in the band. She became the business manager as well as road manager. She took care of the money. She was taking care of the taxes. She did all that stuff, and it wore her out. And so the last part of the book is about what happens when all that pressure just blew up, and she's, on the other hand, trying to pursue her own career, her own life as someone who's a healer, who knew something about nutrition and juicing, and she had this whole plan to heal people with juicing. And she started her own business. All this in the midst of trying to handle Monk's business. So it's a complicated and interesting story, and it is, to me, one of the greatest love affairs in jazz.
Thelonious Monk performing his composition Crepuscule with Nelly from the Columbia album Crisscross. I'll have more music from Thelonious Monk and more from my interview with Monk biographer Robin D.G. Kelly in just a few moments. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, and 100% fruit smoothies made with locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Thelonious Monk from Myth to Man on Nightlights. Playing the music of Thelonious Monk on this edition of Nightlights and talking with his biographer, Robin D.G. Kelly. You can hear part one of this program on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. As Thelonious Monk gained fame throughout the late 1950s and early 60s, the image that he'd had since the late 1940s, that of an eccentric, somewhat disconnected, and childlike man lost in his own, perhaps drug-altered world, persisted and grew stronger. Monk also gained a reputation for being apolitical, even in regards to the growing civil rights movement. But Robin Kelly says that this was not the case.
This very period, he's involved with a lot of benefits for Congress on Racial Equality, for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, for the civil rights movement generally, and he is very opinionated about what they should do and what they shouldn't do. I think what ends up happening is that in particular interviews, he's asked about politics. And in those interviews, he has a very clear position, and that is that politics is a vocation. He may support movements for liberation, for social change, for freedom, but politics is a vocation. And when someone asked what is his position, he's like, you know, ask a politician. That's not what I do. I'm a musician. And that somehow gets translated into I'm not interested. I'm disinterested in politics or social change.
Thelonious Monk's Bright Mississippi, recorded in 1963 with his working quartet at the time, Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, John Orr on bass, and Frankie Dunlop on drums, for the album Monk's Dream, a recasting of Sweet Georgia Brown, named in tribute to the civil rights movement in the South. Even as he gave quiet but public support to the civil rights generation, Monk had an uneasy relationship with a new wave of young avant-garde musicians, many of whom looked up to him, who were forging new directions in jazz, and who were sometimes politically and racially outspoken in ways that upset some jazz critics, who were also less than sympathetic to their musical aims. Robin Kelly.
It was an interesting, complicated, I wouldn't say love-hate relationship, but a complicated one. On the one hand, the emergence of so-called free jazz, beginning with, you know, Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry, Cecil Taylor, Archie Shepp, a lot of them come out of Monk. The Monk and Ellington were the two most important composers they studied. And so, on the one hand, you have this adoration of Monk from the avant-garde. On the flip side, Thelonious wasn't too keen on that music. He felt like it didn't tell a story. He would say things like, hell, I did that 25 years ago when he heard Ornette Coleman for the first time. I just didn't do it on every note. And so he was skeptical because he felt like what's essential to music is melody. You've got to have melody. He couldn't hear the melody. He thought a lot of it was noise.
In 1962, Monk signed to the Columbia label, home to Miles Davis, Dave Brubeck, and Leonard Bernstein in the New York Philharmonic. Columbia had marketing power, and they paid Monk well, but they also took back much of the money in exploitative account charges. Still, the label's mainstream appeal helped elevate Monk's profile even more, and he was working and touring more than ever before. In early 1964, he even landed on the cover of Time magazine.
The article by Barry Farrell was a kind of schizophrenic piece, beautifully written, but he basically painted two monks in one. One monk was the eccentric, childlike, strange, drug addict, alcoholic monk, and then the other one was the good father, good husband, and most importantly, good human being, because he wasn't like those other guys in their avant-garde race politics. You know, he was colorblind and didn't, as far as Barry Farrell was concerned.
Meanwhile, Monk was recording frequently for Columbia. His 1960s period with the label has often elicited mixed reactions from critics and fans, who have tended to claim that the recordings are competent but less than inspired retreads of well-worn standards and older Monk compositions. Robin Kelly.
With Monk, it was all about making music and making music fresh and making music that's still rooted in his aesthetic principles and aesthetic ideas, but something that always sounded like unlike anything you've heard previously. You know, so, yes, there are times when Monk kind of fell into a routine, but his solos weren't routine, you know? And so that's, I think, the thing you have to pay attention to. Is it's not so much the evolution as much as the constant transformation and renewal of these tunes that became part of his standard repertoire. And for Monk, it's like, so what? You know, you're going to listen to Mozart for the rest of your life, the same pieces. But some conductor is going to draw out a fresh interpretation. Or some string quartet will do something different that you hadn't heard, and yet the song's still there.
Thelonious Monk doing his tune Rhythmining from the Columbia album Crisscross, with Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, John Orr on bass, and Frankie Dunlop on drums. Charlie Rouse was the cornerstone of Monk's 1960s quartet and stayed with him for 12 years. Robin Kelly on their relationship.
Monk really liked Rouse's sound. He loved the tenor saxophone, and he liked the big sound, and he liked someone who could swing. That's very, very important. He didn't like a whole lot of abstraction, and he made a commitment to Monk. He learned music. He became kind of a musical director. You know, he made sure that other band members, as they come in and out of the band, knew what to do. Rouse was a great listener, you know, so if Monk wanted him to do something, Rouse would do it. He wouldn't argue. And the other thing is that Charlie Rouse, he was incredibly unselfish. Rouse was able to understand Monk, play with him, make it sound fresh, and he was the fall guy. When the criticisms came down on Monk's quartet for being staid and for being routine, it was Rouse who got the bulk of the criticism, I think unfairly, you know. And he did the best he could with what he had, you know. So the other thing about Rouse, and I can't stress this enough, I think people have been sleeping on his skill as an improviser. You know, he has little quirks, little things that he likes to do, little sort of skip movements and stuff like that, skip phrases. He loved that, but he was a wonderful musician. And if you don't believe it, go back and listen to Rouse with Fats Navarro, or listen to Rouse with Dizzy Gillespie, and go back and listen to those recordings from the 40s. I mean, the man can play, you know. So here you've got someone who really could play, who could have been a leader, who could have had a different trajectory, but he sacrificed a lot to make sure that Monk had what he needed to play his music. Thank you.
Thelonious Monk, Charlie Rouse, and Mysterioso live at the IT Club in Los Angeles in 1964, a black-owned club that Robin Kelly says was one of Monk's favorites, and the album that Monk made there is generally regarded as one of his best from the 1960s.
Monk loved playing the IT Club because McLean respected him so much and let him do whatever he wanted to do. And his club was located near one of Monk's favorite pool halls. You know, Monk loved to play pool, so he'd always look for a pool hall. And so during his breaks, he'd go over and shoot a few games. And Monk had some difficulties during his 64 gig at the IT Club. You know, he was suffering some bipolar episodes. And despite all that, was able to create some really fantastic music.
Monk had been suffering psychological problems off and on for years that would end up requiring hospitalization on several occasions. Doctors had given him Thorazine, which left him sluggish, and another doctor had been giving him vitamin shots that were packed with speed.
Here's Monk with amphetamines running through his body under the guise of vitamin shots, along with Thorazine, which is a depressant, mixed together, and he has these sort of bipolar highs and lows, these depression followed by manic behavior, followed by depression. I mean, it was a mess. I mean, it was a pharmaceutical mess. And so when Barry Farrell in his article talks about every day is a pharmaceutical adventure for Monk, he's not at all addressing the fact that some of those drugs are prescribed. He's not addressing, no one's addressing that, you know? And so it's not until, ironically, the 70s when he is retiring from music and decides not to play that he is given lithium treatments, which stabilizes him and makes him more comfortable. It certainly has a deleterious effect on his creative drive, but the bipolar episodes pretty much disappear.
Monk would spend those later years living at the house of a longtime friend, the so-called jazz baroness, Panonica Rothschild, or Nika, a European aristocrat and jazz lover who'd moved to New York City in 1951. In the jazz world, Nika was somewhat of a patron saint, helping out musicians financially and in other ways, and from the mid-1950s on, she had been close to Monk, though not, Robin Kelly says, in the way that many have assumed.
Well, the biggest misconception, of course, is that they were lovers, and they were not even close. She was like an eccentric aunt, you know, if anything. And she, and Monk described her as, besides Nellie, perhaps his best friend later in his life. You know, Sonny, Nellie's brother, was his best friend for a long time. But the other thing about the Baroness is that, you know, it's kind of a myth to think of her as completely committed to just Thelonious Monk. She was committed to jazz. And, you know, it's not an accident that so many musicians wrote songs that paid tribute to her.
this month performing Panonica, his tribute to his friend the jazz baroness Panonica Rothschild, another recording from his Columbia era. Robin Kelly again on Monk's Late Period.
I deal with a lot of the negative stuff they had to deal with, the exploitation, the money. I also deal with the music, and I end up concluding that except for the record you did with Oliver Nelson's arrangement, except for that, he made some fabulous albums for Columbia, and I think they're slept on. I mean, there's a way that because of Orrin Keep News, the Riverside records become kind of the paramount. But I think Teal Macero produced some wonderful underground, an LP that deserves even more study. The sexiest version I've ever heard of Easy Street, you know, by anybody. You know, the tunes he's writing late, you know, as much as he's struggling to write new tunes, Boo Boo's Birthday and Green Chimneys, I mean, these are simple tunes that just pack so much swing. So I think musically, you've got to go back and like pay attention to those Columbia recordings and see just how he is sustaining something new and fresh at a time when it's almost impossible to do so given his schedule, given the pressures on him, and given his age.
Monk performing Boo Boo's Birthday, written for his daughter and recorded at the end of 1967. By the end of the 1960s, Thelonious Monk was running down, wearied by constant touring, pressure to record and compose, and the natural erosion of age. Throughout the early 1970s, his public appearances would become more and more sporadic, and by some accounts, less and less engaged. Robin Kelly.
By that time, the gigs were few and far between. The money wasn't right. It was hard work to make a living. I mean, really hard work. His record label, Columbia, had dropped him, basically. They'd been trying to drop him since 69. And they just quietly sort of let his contract lapse. So he wasn't under contract with any record label. He couldn't find people to really play his music. He was having a lot of physical issues, flus and colds all the time. And prostate, he had an enlarged prostate, which made it uncomfortable to just sit at the piano. So when you have incontinence issues and you're a piano player and you're used to playing long gigs, I mean, it gets to the point where it's no longer fun. And that's why I conclude, again, contrary to kind of popular belief, it made perfect sense for him to quit, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there was nothing left that was fun in the music for him. And if it's no longer fun, why do it?
As his physical and psychological health declined, Monk moved in with his friend Nika, the jazz baroness.
When it was decided that Monk move in with her in January of 73, certainly that had to do with some tensions in Monk's household, but it also had a lot to do with the fact that Nika had the resources so that he could have a room to himself with a bathroom, which he needed because of his prostate condition. A piano. He had basically the whole upstairs of her house and could live there comfortably and have the proper medical care that he needed. You know, the place that he had to go for his treatment was in Princeton, and so it was a lot easier to go from Weehawken to Princeton than to come in and out from Manhattan. And the other thing is that Nellie, who remained committed to her husband, would come over on the bus almost every day and cook for Monk and take care of him and do whatever. So the two of them together worked as a team to make sure Monk was happy, comfortable, and had what he needed. You know, she was very committed to him.
Thelonious Monk died in 1982 at the age of 64. He hadn't performed in public for years, and he rarely played the piano that the Baroness had provided for him. He remained shrouded in the mythic high priest of bebop image that had been crafted for him in the late 1940s, and which had eventually overwhelmed the reality of the creative, funny, sensitive, and loving person whose music and way of living was very much his own. For Robin Kelly, undertaking Monk's biography was a 14-year-long investigation into that reality that gave us such a rich musical legacy.
To me, a musician is more than a musician. He is a fully realized human being, And that means you have to know about their family, about the loves of their lives, about their demons, about their community. And so for me, writing about San Juan Hill as a community and writing about his mother and his roots is extremely important for understanding not just the artist, but the man.
Thelonious Monk once said, jazz is a music that can bring true friendship.
I think Monk meant that from experience. And by true friendship, I think there's several things. One is that he's living through the period of the jazz ambassadors, where his friend Dizzy Gillespie is, and others, Randy Weston, are traveling all over, you know, and really spreading the word of jazz. The other thing is that, you know, Monk, who played at the United Nations and places like that, felt like, again, as a diplomatic means, jazz is a beautiful way of quieting down the noise and creating a real dialogue around something that he felt was universal. It doesn't take color or nationality or gender to play this music. You learn it, you play it, you express yourself, and you can be yourself. And I think all that is something that Monk was very attuned to. And so when he said that, again, in his own laconic, you know, very, he had a sort of sense of brevity, he really, really was saying something much, much bigger than those words.
Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Robin D.G. Kelly. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, and 100% fruit smoothies made with locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can listen to other Nightlights programs and view playlists, jazz news, and commentaries on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. This is David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.